For decades, economists have pointed to 17th century tulip mania as a warning about the perils of the free market. Writers and historians have reveled in the absurdity of the event. The incident even provides the backdrop for the new film Tulip Fever, based on a novel of the same name by Deborah Moga. The only problem? None of these stories are true. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to the show. This is Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We have a great little piece today. Shout out to BTC Viking for bringing this back to my attention, actually. I had saved this article like 2 or 3 years ago, but at the time I was still working really hard to reach out for permission for every single article and for every single author, and I never heard back on this one, and so it just kind of got buried in my list. I didn't remember to refresh it. And it just feels like a really great time to revisit this. It's not a very long one, but it's about something that almost nobody actually knows. Even the people who talk about tulip mania, and then the people who argue against the fact that, you know, Bitcoin is obviously not tulip mania. Most don't even realize that the tulip madness of the early 1600s is largely just a huge exaggeration of something that was, in fact, actually pretty boring. And that's what we are getting into today. And if you weren't keeping up with it, this is also why the output has been really crappy this week. But thank you so much to everyone who has sent prayers and well wishes to my dad. My dad's in the hospital right now after a major heart surgery. But he appears to be recovering, and hopefully he will be waking up tonight. Probably won't remember, but we might get a chance to talk to him. We're on the back end of all this, so stress levels have dropped a hell of a lot, and I can actually relax a little bit enough to do some reading. So we are going to go ahead and get into the article. This piece is from Smithsonian Magazine, and is written by Lorraine Boissonneau, and it really has nothing to do with Bitcoin specifically, except for the fact that it does mention Bitcoin once in the article, and obviously, like 90% of the discussion today around tulip mania is essentially a criticism of Bitcoin. So I just think this is a really, really good article that's important for getting a little bit of perspective. Really quick, a huge thanks to my hardware wallet of choice for supporting the show, the Bitbox O2 from Shift Crypto, the open source, secure, and easy to use method for holding your own keys. And of course, you get 5% off with my promo code Guy, G-U-Y, at checkout. GuySwan.com/Bitbox will take you right there. And our other wonderful sponsor, Swan Bitcoin, your automated, no hassle Bitcoin savings plan. I automatically buy every single week. I smash buy on the dips when I've just got too much fiat burning a hole in my pocket, and it auto withdraws to my keys free of charge. SwanBitcoin.com/guy gets you $10 for free just for starting your plan. With that, let's jump into today's article, and it's titled, There Never Was a Real Tulip Fever, by Lorraine Boissonneau. A new movie sets its doomed entrepreneurs amidst 17th century tulip mania, but historians of the phenomenon have their own bubble to burst. When tulips came to the Netherlands, all the world went mad. A sailor who mistook a rare tulip bulb for an onion and ate it with his herring sandwich, was charged with a felony and thrown in prison. A bulb named Semper Augustus, notable for its flame-like white and red petals, sold for more than the cost of a mansion in a fashionable Amsterdam neighborhood, complete with coach and garden. As the tulip market grew, speculation exploded, with traders offering exorbitant prices for bulbs that had yet to flower. And then, as any financial bubble will do, the tulip market imploded, sending traders of all incomes into ruin. For decades, economists have pointed to 17th century tulip mania as a warning about the perils of the free market. Writers and historians have reveled in the absurdity of the event. The incident even provides the backdrop for the new film Tulip Fever, based on a novel of the same name by Deborah Moga. The only problem? None of these stories are true. What really happened, and how did the story of Dutch tulip speculation get so distorted? Anne Goldger discovered the historical reality when she dug into the archives to research her book, Tulip Mania: Money, Honor, and Knowledge in the Dutch Golden Age. Quote, "I always joke that the book should be called Tulip Mania, more boring than you thought," says Goldger, a professor of early modern history at King's College London. "People are so interested in this incident because they think they can draw lessons from it. I don't think that's necessarily the case." But before you even attempt to apply what happened in the Netherlands to more recent bubbles, the South Sea bubble in 1700s England, the 19th century railway bubble, the dot-com bubble, and Bitcoin are just a few comparisons Goldger has seen, you have to understand Dutch society at the turn of the 17th century. For starters, the country experienced a major demographic shift during its war for independence from Spain, which began in the 1560s and continued into the 1600s. It was during this period that merchants arrived in port cities like Amsterdam, Haarlem, and Delft and established trading outfits, including the famous Dutch East India Company. This explosion in international commerce brought enormous fortune to the Netherlands, despite the war. In their newly independent nation, the Dutch were mainly led by urban oligarchies comprised of wealthy merchants, unlike other European countries of the era, which were controlled by landed nobility. As Goldger writes in her book, "The resultant new faces, new money, and new ideas helped to revolutionize the Dutch economy in the late 16th century." As the economy changed, so too did social interactions and cultural values. A growing interest in natural history and a fascination with the exotic among the merchant class meant that goods from the Ottoman Empire and farther east fetched high prices. The influx of these goods also drove men of all social classes to acquire expertise in newly in-demand areas. One example Goldger gives is fish auctioneer Adrian Kernan, whose watercolored illustrated manuscript, Whale Book, allowed him to actually meet the president of Holland. And when Dutch botanist Carolus Clusius established a botanical garden at the University of Leiden in the 1590s, the tulip quickly rose to a place of honor. Originally found growing wild in the valleys of the Tian Shan Mountains, at the border where China and Tibet meet Afghanistan and Russia, tulips were cultivated in Istanbul as early as 1055. By the 15th century, Sultan Mehmed II of the Ottoman Empire had so many flowers in his 12 gardens that he required a staff of 920 gardeners. Tulips were among the most prized flowers, eventually becoming the symbol of the Ottoman, writes gardening correspondent for The Independent, Anna Pavard, in The Tulip. The Dutch learned that tulips could be grown from seeds or buds that grew on the mother bulb. A bulb that grows from seed would take 7 to 12 years before flowering, but a bulb itself could flower the very next year. Of particular interest to Clusius and other tulip traders were, quote, "broken bulbs," tulips whose petals showed a striped, multicolor pattern rather than a single, solid color. The effect was unpredictable, but the growing demand for these rare, broken bulb tulips led naturalists to study ways to reproduce them. The pattern was later discovered to be the result of a mosaic virus that actually makes the bulb sickly and less likely to reproduce. The high market price for tulips, to which the current version of Tulip Mania refers, were prices for particularly beautiful broken bulbs, writes economist Peter Garber. Since breaking was unpredictable, some have characterized tulip mania among growers as a gamble, with growers vying to produce better and more bizarre variegations and feathering. After all the money Dutch speculators spent on the bulbs, they only produced flowers for about a week, but for tulip lovers, that week was a glorious one. As luxury objects, tulips fit well into a culture of both abundant capital and new cosmopolitanism, Goldger writes. Tulips required expertise, an appreciation of beauty and the exotic, and of course, an abundance of money. Here's where the myth comes into play. According to popular legend, the tulip craze took hold of all levels of Dutch society in the 1630s. Quote, "The rage among the Dutch to possess them was so great that the ordinary industry of the country was neglected, and the population, even to its lower dregs, embarked in the tulip trade," wrote Scottish journalist Charles Mackay in his popular 1841 work, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. According to this narrative, everyone from the wealthiest merchants to the poorest chimney sweeps jumped into the tulip fray, buying bulbs at high prices and selling them for even more. Companies formed just to deal with the tulip trade, which reached a fever pitch in late 1636. But by February 1637, the bottom fell out of the market. More and more people defaulted on their agreement to buy the tulips at the prices they'd promised, and the traders who had already made their payments were left in debt or bankrupted. At least, that's what has always been claimed. In fact, quote, "There weren't that many people involved and the economic repercussions were pretty minor," Goldger says. "I couldn't find anybody that went bankrupt. If there had been really a wholesale destruction of the economy, as the myth suggests, that would have been a much harder thing to face." That's not to say that everything about the story is wrong. Merchants really did engage in a frantic tulip trade, and they paid incredibly high prices for some bulbs. And when a number of buyers announced they couldn't pay the high price previously agreed upon, the market did fall apart and cause a small crisis, but only because it undermined social expectations. Quote, "In this case, it was very difficult to deal with the fact that almost all of your relationships are based on trust, and people said, 'I don't care, I said I'm going to buy this thing, I don't want it anymore, and I'm not going to pay for it.' There was really no mechanism to make people pay because the courts were unwilling to get involved," Goldger says. But the trade didn't affect all levels of society, and it didn't cause the collapse of industry in Amsterdam and elsewhere. As Garber, the economist, writes, "While the lack of data precludes a solid conclusion, the results of the study indicate that the bulb speculation was not obvious madness." So, if tulip mania wasn't actually a calamity, why was it made out to be one? We have tetchy Christian moralists to blame for that. With great wealth comes great social anxiety, or as historian Simon Schama writes in The Embarrassment of Riches, an interpretation of Dutch culture in the Golden Age, quote, "The prodigious quality of their success went to their heads, but it also made them a bit queasy." All the outlandish stories of economic ruin, of an innocent sailor thrown in prison for eating a tulip bulb, of chimney sweeps wading into the market in hopes of striking it rich, those come from propaganda pamphlets published by Dutch Calvinists worried that the tulip-propelled consumerism boom would lead to societal decay. Their insistence that such great wealth was ungodly has even stayed with us to this day. Quote, "Some of the stuff hasn't lasted, like the idea that God punishes people who are overreaching by causing them to have the plague. That's one of the things people said in the 1630s, Goldger says. But the idea that you get punished if you overreach, you still hear that. It's all pride goes before the fall." Goldger doesn't begrudge novelists and filmmakers for taking liberties with the past. It's only when historians and economists neglect to do their research that she gets irked. She herself didn't set out to be a mythbuster. She only stumbled upon the truth when she sat down to look through old documentation of the popular legend. "I had no way of knowing this existed before I started reading these documents," Goldger says. That was an unexpected treasure. All right, and that'll wrap it up. There never was a real tulip fever. And I want to talk about this just a little bit before we close today's episode. Let's hit our sponsor real fast and we will jump back in. You know what's rare? A win-win situation where two parties can both get a huge benefit and neither has a real cost. Like getting yourself a Swan Bitcoin savings account. You get a no-stress, no-hassle Bitcoin savings plan today, and your future self gets sovereignty in the Bitcoin world. Then there's even the more rare win-win-win scenario, like getting a $10 for free in sats just for starting your savings plan, and another layer of winning by never having to stress day and night over the price charts. And even another win by getting auto withdrawals to your own keys for free. No on-chain fees. Swan covers those and gets those keys into your possession to ensure true Bitcoin sovereignty. And then, the rarest of all, the great white whale of deals, where you even get to support Bitcoin Audible just by signing up. The win-win-winning-win-win scenario. And all you have to do is go to swanbitcoin.com/guy and start your savings plan today. So how do we go from, you know, destroyed the entire industry, people were sent to prison for accidentally eating one, that it sent the entire economy into financial ruin, and it's one of the most important events in economic history, to Goldgar's analysis, her research, where she says, quote, "I couldn't find anybody that went bankrupt." You know, I wanted to get her book, which they actually have a link to it. Again, this is on the Smithsonian.com like website, and it's an older article. It's back from 2017, but I wanted to get her book. They link to it, and it's like $35 or $40. But you can rent it for $10 for like a month if you just rent the PDF. And I kind of wanted to skim through some of the chapters and kind of get into the gritty details. And I probably wouldn't read the whole thing, but I'd hit some like really interesting sounding chapters just to have some good details to add to the show. But obviously, if you've been following, it's been a little bit busy with other things. And to be perfectly honest, after thinking about it and thinking about how much time it would take, probably just doesn't need a huge deep dive for the simple fact that you're diving into details of something that wasn't very exciting and, you know, was essentially a big nothing burger in the context of history. And it's funny how this sort of thing happens, how this story just gets perpetuated. And kind of the picture that I held in my head, how I'm thinking about this is that this is kind of like, look at the state of journalism and clickbait and propaganda that we have today. And imagine if that was the only source of information that we had to make sense of what the world looks like today in 50 years or so. You know, what would actually be accurate? Would it be obvious from all the clickbait headlines and the mass shootings and all this stuff that we actually have a continuously declining rate of violent crime and homicide over the past century? I mean, sure, there's moments of volatility, and I haven't looked at the most recent data. I wouldn't doubt that 2020 has an uptick. Well, because of, look what happened. We're in lockdowns and we have riots and stuff all over the world. But we've had many of those sorts of events and periods throughout the last 100 years, but nonetheless, there's a clear and obvious decline in the trend. Then would it be obvious that we have far fewer problems and that the impact from all weather and climate-related events has diminished to a staggering degree, that it's actually in the high 90s for percentage? Like I think it's like 95-ish or something like that, 95% of deaths and destruction, like financial destruction, economic destruction from weather and climate events has just vanished over the past century or so? Would the clickbait headlines make it clear that again, outside of just some volatility, another thing is 2020 and government lockdowns were a huge step backward, but general worldwide poverty has been in the steepest decline ever. That what we complain about today in regards to our environmental and health impact, it's not about feces and sewage literally running through the streets. It's not about heavily toxic or poisonous chemicals being dumped by the millions of gallons just into river water. And what's funny is that there's this element of history where the outrage about some sort of problem actually peaks as the problem is being solved, generally. You know, 200 years ago, there were no candlelight vigils for poverty. Poverty was just kind of the state of things. And the same thing with most pollution and the consequences, like in the environmental impact from cities and things. Like there's this hugely famous fire on the Hudson River that created massive outrage. Like literally there was so much disgusting material and chemicals in the Hudson River that the river itself burst into flames. And this caused huge outrage. It was a massive story and ended up leading to the creation of the EPA. And it's usually told historically as this story about how horrible everything was and how the EPA came in and fixed it. But if you actually look at the data, you'll notice that the reason everyone was outraged by the Hudson River fire is because river fires suddenly had become rare. The problem was already solved, but then you have this one big event that happens on the tail end of actually cleaning up our environmental impact, because it's the natural state of technological innovation and movement forward, is we want our places to be clean. Nobody likes walking through sewage. But the outrage peaks went just when you start to get people comfortable or used to the fact that the problem is solved, and then you find out that it's not entirely solved. The reason there was no outrage, there were many, many, many river fires. Like, this situation was not at all uncommon. And the further back you go, like during the Industrial Revolution and stuff, it was a horrible issue. But it was normal. It was so bad that it was literally normal. Like, the EPA didn't solve the problem. The problem was being solved, which led people to, for it to become less frequent enough that it was no longer a normal thing. And then when it happened again, when suddenly we did have another big fire on the tail end of actually solving the problem, everybody freaks out. The sensational side of things is almost always the response to something outside of what we are relatively used to. What is frequent and what is considered normal and acceptable. We get used to horrible things, like terrible conditions. If they just become like the normal state of things, well, then they just become the things that we expect. And in the context of the environment, the environmental impact and the pollution and stuff, what's the great boogeyman of today? What's the great enemy of the modern era? Carbon dioxide. A completely normal atmospheric gas is not toxic to anybody or anything. That plants literally breathe and may lead to the climate getting warmer, which generally kind of means that the planet would be able to sustain a lot more life. Now, sure, there are any sort of trade-offs that come with anything here, and I'm not really making any claim one way or the other than the fact that those things that I said are in fact true. This is not exactly the worst boogeyman that we could dream up. And one thing I always thought was funny about this whole thing was, like, if you go to NASA.gov, you can read about it in a bunch of different places, but NASA has some really great imagery and data on this that aren't projection models. It's like just actual data and images of the planet. It's referred to as the Great Greening or the Greening of Earth or something like that. And it's about the increased carbon dioxide output. Leading to the fertilization and the thickening of all green life, essentially around the entire planet. And this has happened over the last like 20 or 30 years. Now, of course, you can obviously find a New York Times article that admits that this is the case, but then talks about how this is actually a horrible thing for the environment. But whatever, you know, like that's the relationship, right? Like that's the new totem for what is normal and how we're supposed to hate this new thing when really, like the clickbait headline is how horrible everything is. And obviously there are massive numbers of problems. If you look 50 years into the future and then we go 50 years into the future and then look back, probably everything is going to seem insane to the degree of trash or pollution or impact that we have today, because innovation and new technologies will increasingly make that impact less and less, will allow us to utilize more and more energy with less and less externalities or waste. I mean, that's what that is, right? It means that we're making use of more of it rather than throwing it away. And same thing with today. When we look back 50 years, it looks like insanity. But does journalism make any sense of that? Do you get that sense when we're looking at clickbait headlines, when we're looking at the propaganda of the day? No, we see that it's the worst that it's ever been, and it's never a recognition of the trend. It's never a recognition of the movement of these things. It's almost always just a flat, linear picture of what it is today, and then some great discussion about how horrific it is. Now, this is not unexpected, but it's also not proper history. The quote from this piece says, "Those come from the propaganda pamphlets published by Dutch Calvinists worried that the tulip-propelled consumerism boom would lead to societal decay. Their insistence that such great wealth was ungodly has even stayed with us to this day." The lesson we should take from this is that sensational sells, and then it gets repeated. And if it satisfies what somebody wants to be true or that they feel to be true, it will get endlessly retold as the truth, no matter how exaggerated or nonsensical it actually is. And then via the law of least resistance, it becomes the first and easiest thing, the simplest story to stumble upon when digging through history. And then 500-ish years later, we are still talking, or 400, we are still talking about something that essentially equates to a tabloid and a supremely exaggerated story of what was an isolated wealthy person's market. And it's told to us today as some critically important, huge moment in the history of chaotic and madness of markets. And of course, today, the financially privileged journalists and clickbait headlines, the journalists who come across magic internet money, obviously, to them, have had that which has no purpose, whatever, just speculation, and it runs on the greater fool theory. Well, here comes that 400-year-old anti-rich tabloid about tulips as defense of how to explain what this ridiculous Bitcoin phenomenon really is. It's all just the tulip bubble. And it's not as if this isn't common, right? I think we should think of most of history as an exaggeration. I mean, there are so many stories that were in fact just the better telling or the more iconic story. There's a great book called, I'm not going to be able to remember. I think it was either Wired for Story or possibly Fascinate by Sally Hogshead. Wired for Story is by like Lisa Krohn or something like that. But whichever one it was, the book talked about all of these huge moments or these like iconic stories in history, like Paul Revere and his riding from town to town to let everybody know the English were coming, and how somehow he was famous. He had a very American name, and like so his story became the iconic one, even though there was another guy, which I can't remember his name, funny enough, who rode like 20 times the distance doing the exact same thing and let almost the entire East Coast know, like he spread the word, made Paul Revere basically look like an amateur in the same job, And then there's like the Red Baron, who was like really famous. I think it was Fascinate, because the idea was about branding and about how it is that the story and like sensationalism of a certain type of narrative can just last for an eternity. And it was about how the Red Baron was obviously a brilliant and scary pilot, but it was branding that made him so scary, and that by showing the underside of the plane, by, you know, making himself stand out in the crowd, he was that much more intimidating. But if you actually look at the details, it was actually an Allied pilot that fired like a third as many bullets as the Red Baron. Essentially, the Red Baron was, in fact, a very amazing pilot, obviously, and shot down tons of enemy planes, but that he was basically a sprayer, right? He was really trigger happy. He was not super efficient, and he was kind of a brute in behind the stick. Whereas there was an Allied pilot who actually shot down many more planes than the Red Baron did, and did so on like a third as many bullets. But he wasn't famous. But he didn't have that iconic, sensational idea of him. Nobody knew when he was flying into battle, and therefore his story didn't stick around. But if you dig, you can find the truth of history. And then I'm in the process of reading a book called The Not-So-Wild Wild West. And this is an idea that I've just been, since I first dug into this book a long time ago, and now I'm kind of back to it after all this time, was that the Wild West is essentially the same thing as, it's a very, very parallel story to the Tulip Mania. It was not the chaos that we think of as the Wild West. A statistic that I heard once, I think it was like Tom Woods talked about it in a speech once, but that, like, we have this idea that it was just everybody was killing everybody, that there was all this strife, everybody was out there for riches, like all the conditions were perfect for a completely chaotic and violent era. And oddly enough, the stories of any violence spread very quickly, because that's what it seemed like, that's what people were expecting, so that's what sold. But the number of, you know, you hear about all these bank robberies and Billy the Kid and all these like famous thieves. Well, the entire period and the entire area, like all the way from, you know, northern Mexico all the way up to the Canadian border, like all of this land that was settled during this era and for the decades that were referred to as the Wild West, there were actually fewer bank robberies during the entire period than they are in total 1 year in Chicago. But why? Why did that crazy version of history, when it turns out to just be a big giant bore, how did such a skewed version of history persist? Because it was a really great story. And much like how the Tulip Mania was exaggerated by essentially the religious prudes of the day who just wanted to demonize something that felt really good to demonize, and they had the Calvinist propaganda pamphlets that ended up being our source of history. Well, in the Wild West, where do the gunslinging, violent, like everybody shoots everybody in the bar vision of the Wild West come from? Dime novels. People would go west, and then they would write all these elaborate comic book-esque stories, just these cheap little short stories about their huge conquests and how they fought the Indians with their bare hands and all this insanity, and it was just made up. It just sounded really good, and for all the ignorant people back on the East Coast that heard about the scary new frontier, they sold. They sold. They wanted the comic book version of reality. And that story got retold over and over and over again. And then it got made into movies and books and everything else. And today, it's the Wild West, even though it was mostly just kind of the boring settled West more than anything. So it's just, and it's kind of a weird rant, but it's just important, I think, to keep perspective on this, is things that we take for granted are so often not true. You know, they just fit, right? It was just a puzzle piece that fit and fulfilled some sort of need to tell a story or to hate somebody that they wanted to hate, or it was really good fodder for a new digital currency that you swore wasn't of any use, and its price just kept increasing in price. So clearly the only explanation was tulips. And there's no reason to go digging and finding out if tulip mania was true or not. All you're looking for is a good two sentences of fodder to explain away Bitcoin, because that's what's comfortable. That's what they want to do. That's the answer they want. That's the history they want. So they just stop. And this is basically human nature, right? We're just bias machines. It's not like I'm making any argument that I'm immune to this. That's absurd. No, of course I'm not. But it's just a perspective. It's just something to remember when you hear these stories, when you look at this stuff, that just because something is popular, just because something is well known, certainly does not mean it is the truth. And I will have the links to the original book by Goldgar that this article is kind of a response and or I guess maybe a summation of. So if anybody does want to dig into it and get some more details, I may break down and do it myself. We'll see. If you think it's worth another episode, let me know. Hit me up, shoot me a message on Twitter or something and say, yeah, let's dig into Tulip Mania and see just how crazy it was. My image of the time is kind of like, I'm inclined to think that it was probably something like the modern art industry today. It did get out of hand. It did get ridiculous. It did have, you know, like you might have a painting of just like a white canvas with like a blue dot on it, sells for millions of dollars. Sure, I'm sure there was something ridiculous like one special bulb with one red petal where all the other ones were white, just sold for an exorbitant amount of money. But if the modern art industry crashes and suddenly the painting that somebody bought for $20 million that just has a blue dot on it only sells for like $200,000, yeah, most everybody's just going to laugh at it. Like, okay, big deal. Ha ha ha, they had it coming to them, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of what I think my view of it is now. And the next time you hear a journalist spouting off about how Bitcoin is clearly just tulip fever all over again, just remember, there never really was a real tulip fever. Huge thank you to Bitbox and Swan Bitcoin for keeping this show alive. This is Bitcoin Audible. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been Bitcoin Audible, a 111 production.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.